All right, good morning, everybody. It's good to be back with all of you. We're going to be in Daniel 11, which is, there's some hard things about this chapter, but we'll work through some of it and then focus on some applications from it. But Randy's going to begin us in a word of prayer, so let's all bow. All right, as we're nearing the end of the book of Daniel, just remind ourselves, the first six chapters, you had Daniel interpreting the dreams of other kings. And then when you get to chapter 7 through 12, you have Daniel receiving dreams that he needs interpretations of, which becomes helpful when we get to chapters 10 through 12, because these really form one section. We have to break it up into multiple classes. But in chapter 10, what Jesse taught last week, you have Daniel seeing this vision of this man, and it's really similar to this vision that happens in Revelation chapter 1. And Daniel is asking about events that are going to happen in the future, and so the man comes in chapter 10, and then in chapters 11 and 12, he's answering the prayer that Daniel has about this time period that is really dealing with the 400 years of silence. So we talk about how there's the 400 years between Malachi and Matthew, and how there were no living, breathing prophets in that time period. That's true, but Daniel did still talk about that time period. Now, one thing I'll say about chapter 11 specifically is that this is an extremely detailed prophecy. It's going to lay out a lot of the kings from the north and the south, and we'll talk about what all of that means in just a moment, that reigned during the 400 years of silence. And this, the detailed nature of this chapter has caused skeptics to say that Daniel had to have been written around 150 BC. But of course, we know that the Septuagint was made before all of that, and so this is direct revelation that Daniel was receiving about that time period. Something else to say about maybe one of the main ideas of this chapter. We've been trying to make connections between Daniel and 1 Peter. 1 Peter ends by saying, this is the true grace of God, stand firm in it. And he has to say this is the true grace because there are false graces, false concepts of God's grace. And throughout 1 Peter, he's explaining what the true grace is. And he tells him to stand firm in it. Look at Daniel 11, verse 32. Because during these 400 years of silence, there's going to be major persecution against the Jews. And this is the main application of the chapter. Daniel 11, verse 32 says, he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. So as we go through this, there's going to be a lot of details. But just know that the main thrust of this chapter is encouragement for Jews who are going to be going through major political unrest in the world. And it becomes maybe an especially important message for us as things get worse and worse in our nation and how we can learn to stand firm despite what happens here. So, any comments or questions about that? Yeah, Kathy? Yeah, so if people come to the Bible with the presupposition or the assumption that God couldn't know the future because he doesn't really exist anyways, skeptics realize that this is a very detailed and accurate prophecy, so therefore they would say that it was written after the fact. So, yeah. Anything else you guys want to say just by way of introduction to this chapter? All right, let me just outline this for us. Verses 2 through 4 is going to show some breakdown between Persia and Greece, which is going to get us to the wars that happened between Egypt and Syria. That's going to be verses 5 to 20. And then 21 to 45 is going to talk about the major persecutor or major persecutors of God's people. The reason that I say the S there like that is because there's some debate if this is talking about more than one empire that's going against God's people. Okay? So there's going to be a lot of history going on in this chapter. But just keep in mind that chapters 2 to 4 are getting us to Greece, which gets us to the wars that happen here, which then gets us here. So there's kind of like a chain link between how the chapter is structured. Does anybody have any questions just about that? Yeah, Peggy? Right. So when we get to the wars between Egypt and Syria, Egypt is on the south, Syria is on the north. Guess where, what land is in between those two territories? Israel is. So you wonder, okay, why does this matter to the Jews? Why does this history matter to them? Because Egypt and Syria have all of these fights going on, and Israel's right in the middle. That's why it pertains to them. So, all right, very good. Let's start out with verses 2-4, and we'll see what we can learn from this. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he becomes strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, in other words, not to his children, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to the others beside these. All right, so he says there's going to be three more kings that arise from Persia. If you go back to chapter 10, verse 1, when this section in Daniel begins, who's the king at the time? Cyrus is the king in chapter 10, verse 1. So the three kings after Cyrus would be Cambyses, or however you pronounce that, and then Guamata, and Darius or Darius, however you say that. Historically, those were the three kings that come after that. But then he says that there's going to be a fourth king, and that's Xerxes. If you read the book of Esther, that would be Ahasuerus. It's the same guy historically. And so that's the fourth one. What do we learn about this fourth king? Yeah, he's very wealthy. We see that in the book of Esther. He's extraordinarily wealthy. Anything else that we learn about this guy? Yeah, in the book of Esther he did.
Yeah.
Yep. What else do we learn about this guy? Yeah, so he's going to be fighting against Greece, which gets us into the mighty king in verse 3. So Alexander the Great, the Greco-Romans, the Greece Empire. So in verse 3, that's the mighty king. What do we learn about Alexander the Great in verse 3 and 4? Okay, good. So the kingdom's going to be broken up into four, but it says in verse 4 that it's not going to be to his own posterity, which means his nation is going to continue, but it's not going to continue through his children. It's going to continue through his generals, and we'll talk about those guys in just a moment. Anything else that is said about this guy that's maybe hasn't been said about the other kings so far? Yes. So at the end of verse 3, this guy's going to do as he wills. And it's interesting that phrase is used three times in Daniel 11. Look at verse 16. It says, but he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. Skip down to verse 36. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. So there's three times in this chapter you've got these really wicked, very powerful kinds of kings that do whatever they want, and right after it says that they do whatever they want, they get destroyed. Proverbs says some things about that pride comes before destruction. That happens with all three of these kings. So he dies. Anybody know how old Alexander the Great was when he died? 33, same age that Jesus was when he died. But you've got the four generals from Alexander the Great that ruled. So you have Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. These are going to be the two that are emphasized throughout the rest of the chapter. So the kingdom divides up into four. These are the first kings of those four separate empires. And so when we get to the wars between the north and the south, it's going to be between these specific ones. The top two don't really get dealt with in the rest of the chapter. Do you guys have any comments or questions about that? We're just seeing history that gets us to the point where we can understand the wars that happen in 5-20. So that's just some history. Now we're going to get some more history. 5 to 20 is going to be the most detailed part of this chapter. And you'll see, like in verse 5, for example, then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. So it talks about the king of the south. You're also going to see the king of the north. So the king of the south, that's Egypt, and that's going to be the Ptolemies. Because the first king of that empire was Ptolemy. Ptolemy, the first, second, third, fourth, that becomes a title, just kind of like the Pope is a title. So all of the succeeding kings are going to be named after the first one. Then the king of the north is the Syrians, and that the first one was Seleucus, and so the rest of them are going to be the Seleucids. Seleucid 1, 2, 3, 4. All right? And as we said earlier, the glorious land, or Israel, is going to be caught in the middle between the wars of these two empires that originally came from Alexander the Great. If anybody needs me to slow down, please ask questions. This is a lot of details in this prophecy. Does anybody have any comments or questions up to this point? Yeah. Okay. Yep. All right, anything else? Just keep in mind that as we're going through this, this is all looking forward to the great persecutors, and it's getting us the background for why the Jews were persecuted so much. Were you going to say something, Dave? Yep. Yes. Yep, that would be one of the encouragements to the Jews who received the book of Daniel. God knew before any of this happened that it would happen this way. And so they could go back and look at this and be encouraged by what Daniel had written. All right, what we're going to see in verses 5 to 20, we're not going to look at this in a lot of detail, because if you want to read some history books, you can see how all of this fits. I'm going to put some stuff on the board, but we're going to go through this quickly. But this is maybe the most helpful thing to understand about 5 to 20. It's going to be a series of episodes of wars between the north and the south, between the Syrians and the Egyptians. So it's just going to be one episode of warring after another. And the years in this section is 281 to 175. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Well, just before the wars started.
Okay, good. So Barry said that it was right before the wars started that the Septuagint was written, which would have been around 280. The Septuagint means like 70 or 72 people that helped translate it into Greek, the Old Testament. So the Old Testament would have been like completed at that point, which means that all of this is God's foreknowledge being shown here. All right, so let's just walk through the episodes really quickly. Verse 5 is episode 1. That's the first Ptolemy versus the first Seleucus, or Seleucus himself. And there's some warring that happens, or they kind of establish their nations. So that's verse 5. Verse 6 talks about Ptolemy the second Philadelphus versus Antiochus the second. And these two had tried to do a marriage alliance to get the nations to work together. So you actually had, let me see if I remember, so Ptolemy, he had his daughter Bernice marry Antiochus the second to try to create an alliance between the two nations. Does anybody know what happened with that alliance? It dissolved, the marriage broke up, it didn't create union with unity between the two nations like they thought it would. So that's the second episode. The third one is Ptolemy the third, Urgarets or something like that, and he invades Syria, the north. Syria fights back, and that's the third episode, that's verses 7 to 9. And like I said, you can read the history books and you can see how all of this lines up. Episode 4 is Ptolemy the fourth Philopater versus Antiochus the Great. That's verses 10 to 19. And one of the things that you see going on as these two people are warring is this is where you get in verse 16, the land of Israel specifically being mentioned as the glorious land. But we also get another empire that's starting to come on the scene. And verse 18, as all of these wars are happening, look at verse 18. It says, afterward he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, But a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, and he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. So what's happening here is you've got, I think it was Ptolemy Philopater, the Romans are causing them to have to pay money. Seleucus. The Romans are starting to ask tribute from them, and so you get the Romans getting involved there. I'm not getting all the history down exactly, but do you guys have any comments or questions about that? Yeah. So Antiochus Epiphanes was the son of Antiochus the Great. That's Antiochus the Third right there. So his son is going to be the one that we start talking about in verse 21. And Daniel 11 is getting us to the point where we can understand Antiochus Epiphanes. So this is just background until we get there. So the Roman, this is going to be important for later on as we go through this. But the Seleucus, that's from the north, they have to start paying tribute to Rome. And that's going to get us into the context of Epiphanes, yeah.
So Syria and Egypt are fighting back and forth. One would attack the other would attack the one, back and forth, until Rome took Egypt as a protector.
Right.
And then when Syria attacked them, they stepped on Rome's toes.
Right.
And then that took them out.
Yeah, so that's a good way to say this. So Rome started to protect Egypt. So when the north attacked the south, guess who would come to the south's defense? The Romans. And that's why the Romans threatened the Syrians, and they had to start paying tribute to Rome to make peace with them. Any comments or questions about that?
Well, when he said they went to the islands, and went after the islands, those were Roman islands.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Now, does anybody think this is kind of overwhelming right here, all this information? Let's just step back from all the details and just notice something here. God is laying all of this out before it ever happens. So when you read something like this and your mind starts going all over the place, like, man, there's so many details to keep in check here. I don't know that we're intended to look at this and be able to memorize every single king, but we should be impressed with the fact that God has foreknowledge like this. And in the book of Isaiah, this is one of the things that Isaiah offers as proof that God is God and the idols are not God. Because here's a God who knows the future. And he shows it in an unparalleled passage here. There's no other passage in the Bible I'm aware of that gives this much detail before it ever happens. All right, any comments or questions about that? Yeah, Peggy? Yeah. 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 Yep. And keep in mind, too, that you've got one king after another, after another, after another. One of the words that's repeated all throughout this chapter is arise. In verse 2, there's more kings that arise. Verse 3, there's another king that arises. In verse 7, there's another king that arises. Verse 14, and those times many shall arise against the king of the south. Verse 20, then shall arise in the place of one who shall send an exactor of tribute. All throughout the chapter, there's one king after another arising after another. And this shows you how unstable nations are. And so there might be some things to say about that as we go through this. So anyways, this is just getting us to the major persecutors of the Jews, and this is where we get Antiochus Epiphanes. This is Antiochus the Great's child, and we're going to look at it. This is years 175 to 164 BC. Look at verse 21 and 22. It says, in his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. All right, here's Antiochus Epiphanes. What do you guys see about him just by way of introduction with how he comes to power? What was that? In what verse? So in verse 21, arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain kingdom by flatteries. So he receives honor from the people, that's for sure. But he, in order to get it, he has to do it through flattery, because the person who should have been the next king in line was Antiochus the Great's son. He doesn't become king, and instead it's Antiochus the Great's brother, and that's Epiphanes. Okay? And so he takes it by flattery. What else does he do, though, in this text? So he's deceiving people. Has anybody ever come to power through deceit? Why is that funny? People really haven't changed much, by the way, have they? So you've got him coming to power through deceit, through flattery. What does he do when he comes to power in verse 22? Yeah, he's just like destroying people. He's a very violent kind of guy, even to the point where in verse 22, he destroys the prince of the covenant. Who's the prince of the covenant? Huh? So it could be Antiochus the Great's son who should have been the king. Covenant isn't always a religious term in the Bible. Sometimes it just means like an agreement. So it could be Antiochus the Great's son, or it could be Onias, and he was the priest in Jerusalem at the time. So you could look at it either way, but the point is that he has no regard for authorities. All right, so that's how he comes to power. But if you look at if we start in verse 23, what we're going to see is a sequence of attacks that this guy makes. So in 23 to 27, he attacks Egypt by deceit. So look at verse 23. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his fathers' fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and in his heart against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plot shall be devised against him. So initially he attacks Egypt, he makes an agreement with them, but he lies to them and attacks them anyway. And then on the way back from Jerusalem, that's where he makes his first attack. Or on his way back from Egypt, that's when he makes his first attack on Jerusalem. And after that he tries to attack Egypt again, but then Rome threatened and came to their defense. Look at verse 29 and 30. Start in verse 28. This is when he makes his first attack on Jerusalem. It says, and he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. So he goes back to his own land, attacks Jerusalem. But then verse 29, at the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. All right, here's where we get into some applications. He goes, attacks Egypt again, but what does Rome do? Yeah, Rome intervenes. Does anybody know the story of how Rome intervened? It's kind of interesting. So here's the story. You had Antiochus the Epiphanes, and he's on his way to go destroy Egypt, and here comes some of the ships of Rome, and then the commander of the army of Rome draws a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes and says, by the time you leave this circle, you got to make your decision if you're going to attack or not. And he, like, here's Antiochus Epiphanes seeing these great ships of Rome, and he goes, I'm not doing that. So he backs off, but then what does he do in his frustration? He attacks Jerusalem. Have you ever had a time before where somebody like showed you up and they showed that they were wiser or smarter than you or more powerful than you, and then you got angry and turned around and took it out on somebody else? That's what, none of us have ever done that, I'm sure. That's what Antiochus Epiphanes is doing here. He's frustrated with the Romans stepping in. So he's already attacked Jerusalem at times. So he's gonna go to, he's gonna have an outrage against Jerusalem here. And you see how Daniel's getting us to the point where the audience, the original audience would have been able to see how all of this is transpiring. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah. Right.
And take him out. The Prince of the Covenant may be Ptolemy, maybe the Egyptian, because they had the Syrians had a covenant with them.
Mm-hmm.
To not do this, and then of course this snake ignores the covenant, takes it out.
Right. Yeah, Prince of Covenant doesn't have to be the priest, it could just be any treaties that were made between two nations. Alright, anything else you guys want to say about that? I'm not aware of that. Yeah. I'm not sure about that. Scott? Yes. So what Antiochus is going to do, we'll see this more in just a second, but he's going to seduce with flattery the Jews. And some of them actually came to his side and defected from the truth. And so those are going to be the people that he kind of makes alliances with as he's attacking Jerusalem. All right, any other comments or questions about that? Yeah, Virginia? Yeah, this is a confusing chapter. Okay. So one of the things that this would encourage the Jews with, and we're going to talk about this, is you've got Jews who are going to be going through major persecution from Antiochus Epiphanes. What do people do when they go through suffering? What's the temptation when you're going through suffering? Give up, right? Stop serving God. What if you had a prophecy that said all of this stuff would happen? That would confirm to you that you ought not give up on God because he knows what he's doing and he's in charge of the world. So despite these things that are happening, God is still in control, so you still serve him. That's the message to the original audience, and we're going to see that as we get to verses 32 to 35. The message for us, therefore, would be, if God could do this in the past and he knows how all these things are going to lay themselves out, how much more does he still today, even though we might not have written records of what's going to happen to America? But think about how some Christians in America are talking about the upcoming elections. Like, it's like some people think that the only thing that might be more powerful than God is the next president. Like, people are talking about it in those kinds of terms. Like, they wouldn't say it that way. But America is a nation that is unlike any other, where we haven't had major persecutions against Christianity. And what we're going to see as some of these things ramp up is we're going to see hypocrisy decline and true Christians shine all the more. And so, and we're going to see that as we go through this. Yeah. Yeah, I've read some stuff on it. And what Daniel's saying here is exactly what happens. Yeah. Yeah. Kathy and then Virginia, or then Ida.
Yep. It gives the total view
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that as we go to 32 to 35, but it was a horrible time period. Ida?
As a corollary to what you said, this just shows that they shouldn't be putting their faith in any kind of human government.
Yes.
Whether it's theirs or somebody else's. But the other thing, too, is need for the mighty king.
Right. When you see these kings in this section that are doing whatever they want to do, you can have people that are saying, oh, this is going to be the next leader that's really going to bless us or turn the economy around or change everything for us. And the only king that's ever going to change anything ultimately is Jesus. So, Dave? Yeah, let's, yeah.
I think that to be able to read the detailed prophecy, years of the things that happened, that it comes to pass, and was prophesied before, it forces one to either believe that God has accomplished what he said he would do, or to declare him false. There's no middle ground.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, so let's look at verses 31 to 35, actually. And we'll kind of see what happens with these Jews in this time period. So look at verse 31. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white, until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. All right. Let's talk a little bit then about what Antiochus Epiphanes does to Jerusalem. What things do you see just in the text? And then we'll see if we can connect that to the things that happened in history. Yeah, so the Jews at the beginning of the morning and then at the close of the day, they made a sacrifice in the temple. Does anybody know why the Jews would make the daily sacrifices? Right. And there's a story in it's either First or Second Maccabees where Antiochus Epiphanes forced a family to eat pig meat. And the family was refusing to the point where Antiochus Epiphanes started torturing them. So that's just one example of one of the things that he did. He also set up a gymnasium and had guys wrestle around there naked. He set up a statue of Zeus in the temple. He just completely desecrated the whole thing. Now, try to imagine for a moment that you're a Jew living in this time period. And you've got Antiochus Epiphanes. He's stationed soldiers around. He's already killed 30 to 40,000 of your brothers, fellow brother Jews. What's your temptation in a time like that? Yeah. Yep. Right. And amen to all of that. In verse 33, the wise among them are going to be the ones that stand firm and take action. Wisdom is seeing the end result of something, and from an earthly standpoint, standing firm against Antiochus Epiphanes is dumb, because I'm going to lose my life. True wisdom, though, thinks about eternal life and what the eternal consequences to my actions will be. Think about what God is allowing all this to happen to the nation. And what's happening here is he's allowing the persecution, and what's happening is it's weeding out who the true followers are. And by the way, Jesus would do this in his ministry. In John 6, for example, Jesus challenged the crowds who wanted food from him and said, the only reason you came back here was for food. You didn't see the sign that I'm saying you need to eat my flesh and drink my blood. In other words, my teachings. That's not talking about the Lord's Supper. You need to take in whatever I've said. And then a bunch of people leave. There's other times in the Gospels where there'll be a group of people following Jesus, and he'll turn around and he'll say, you can't be my disciple unless you forsake everything and you hate father, mother, brother, sister, even your own life. And then whenever he does that, he shakes out the people who really care from those who don't. So what is Antiochus Epiphanes being used for here? Who really cares about me? Who really wants to be refined? Who really wants to serve me? And God allows these things to happen so that the genuine can be proved. So think about what's happening in our nation. If persecution ramps up and Christians start to have to meet in houses because we can't have church buildings and all of that kind of thing anymore, or certain laws start to get passed that cause us to not have the kind of freedoms that we used to religiously, some people might say, where's God in all of this? And other people will go through it, and they'll be refined by it, and no matter what the consequences are, they'll keep serving God. But I just have to believe that if things get worse and worse, there's going to be less and less people who meet on Sundays. And there's going to be less and less people who talk about Jesus superficially, and what's going to happen is the true ones are going to be proven. So God, throughout history, God has allowed times like this for us to really realize if we're sincere or not. Do you guys have any comments or questions about that? Yeah. Yep. 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 Because I'm dead, it's Christ that lives in me now. So if I have to suffer like Christ suffered, then I'm going to do that. And by the way, when it says in verse 34, when they stumble, they shall receive a little help. So even amongst the wise people who are standing firm, there's still some cause for stumbling like the apostles had, but they're strengthened through all of this. They're purified. You had a comment, sir? Yeah, amen. Can you imagine being a Jew again, reading this chapter? Like Antiochus Epiphanes starts attacking, and then you've got some Jews that are saying, hey, we've got this prophet Daniel, he wrote this scroll for us. And they start reading chapter 11, because of course there's the chapter numbers back then. And they see all the details, and they go, my goodness, this attack that's happening right now, God knew this was going to happen, and he's trying to test me to see if I'm sincere and pure. This would have been extraordinarily encouraging to those who wanted to stand firm. Let me say something, though. I know we're out of time, but verses 36 to 45, This is the most debated part of this chapter. There's three main views of it. The first one is that it's suddenly jumping to the Antichrist, which we're still waiting for. That's false doctrine. A second view is that it's talking about Rome, and that's a possibility. A third possibility is that it's still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. I bounce between these last two, and depending on which side of the bed I wake up on, I view that differently. But that affects the way that we see chapter 12, which I'm not teaching next week since I'm out of town, so that's good. But here's just some final things. We see the instability of nations throughout this whole chapter. We cannot rely on America. America's not our savior. In verse 30, some of the Jews were seduced with flattery. There's always the temptation to be seduced into the ways of the world and accept the things that the world accepts. And those are the people that are not proven sincere. And then finally, we see that God's control of history is happening throughout this whole chapter. It talks about the appointed time that these things are happening. God knows what he's doing. Our responsibility is to stand firm, though. So, thanks, guys, for your comments.